ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Massive explosion in Bali.
We are very concerned that Australians will be amongst those casualties.
Earthquakes have created massive tidal waves across southeast Asia.
Killed in Indonesia's Aceh province after an initial quake off the island of Sumatra.
Australian officials are already overstretched.
For the first time ever, Indonesia is entering a security agreement with another country.
Ratifying a major security treaty with Indonesia.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with the Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto to finalise the agreement.
Our biggest near neighbour is changing before our very eyes. By the middle of this century, Indonesia is forecast to be the world's fourth largest economy. Imagine that.
Before, we just handwriting. Now we change to the high tech.
A lot of interesting things happens in Indonesia, right? It's a fast growth for economic, especially in the trade.
Hamish has been in Indonesia, gathering a treasure trove of interviews for Global Roaming.
Geraldine, how lucky are we to have this big neighbour, which is, for the most part, democratic, peaceful, growing, which does seem to want to be our friend, but which is interesting and fascinating and dynamic. That, for me, is the thing, the allure of the Indonesia story.
It's getting better. We move forward about the economic changes.
The youth is ready. We are ready.
Are we changing a lot about the economic and the government?
Very eager to have globalisation.
So in this episode, we're kicking off a new mini-series. We're unravelling some of the mysteries of a nation right on our doorstep about which we know so little.
It's Hamish here in Jakarta.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and this is Indonesia Rising from Global Roaming. So now, Hamish, have you enjoyed this? I mean, I know that you've been stimulated, but has it been fun in Indonesia?
It's been a wonderful experience, Geraldine. I love Indonesia. I'm really unashamed about that. It's a country that I've always had a fascination and I've enjoyed working in and travelling to. I haven't been to Jakarta itself for probably about 15 years, and it's a totally different city to the one that I remember. It's modern, it's fast, it's digital. As I mentioned to you the other week, there's a strong coffee culture, you know, very trendy little cafes everywhere, cool bookshops. There's a kind of modern, global feel to this city that I think wasn't there before. But, you know, Indonesia, as ever, it's very difficult to pigeonhole, very difficult to describe it as one thing. I think that's something that I'm kind of reacquainting myself with, is that you can't actually neatly describe Indonesia. It is this vast archipelago, 16,000 islands, 17,000 islands, hundreds of different cultures and languages and ethnicities. And so that growth, that promise, that optimism isn't everywhere. And plenty of Indonesians will list for you all of the things that they still think need to be fixed.
Yeah, well, look, I had quite an exposure to, I also was fascinated by Indonesia through most of my early reporting time, and went there and sat on, you know, groups that went and looked at it. And then my family were posted there. So I actually went forward and back. And I have to honestly say I lost a bit of interest in those, I regret to say. So I'm interested to hear you say that.
Mm. Look, I mean, on this mini-series, Jerry, I'm going to take you on the Whoosh train, the new high-speed rail link
that's been built. Oh, that was just starting when I was last there. I didn't know whether it would ever come true, you know?
And look, it's happened, not without its problems. There's huge amounts of debt that is owed to Chinese creditors. The Sovereign Wealth Fund is having to renegotiate that debt. There's a corruption inquiry. It was overdue in its delivery. And yet, you can now get on a train from Jakarta and get to Bandung in about 35 minutes.
Wow.
And it reaches 350 km/h. It's pretty impressive. It's not you know, the Indonesia that I worked in. There's now a metro system here in Jakarta. You're going to meet the CEO of the metro system in this mini-series. They delivered it 100% on time and on budget, Geraldine.
Is Jakarta still sinking? That was also...
Yes.
It is it?
Yes, they've got these terrible problems with subsidence. Not as bad, I think, as some of the cities in the Philippines, but it is an issue. I think it is worth saying, though, that Indonesia is not just Jakarta and it's not just Java. And
true.
I think there's a great risk often with seeing Java as the country, like... I think something like 60% of the economy is Java. And that's a risk as well for Indonesia. Prabowo has sort of, the new president, has shifted away somewhat from those major capital works projects that Jokowi was so big on commissioning, things like rail and toll roads and wharves. Instead, Prabowo is trying to roll out this free lunch meal program across the country, which is incredibly expensive and already has a lot of problems around it. And that does seem to be coming at the expense of some of the infrastructure that's so needed. And so, you know, I've just been in Sumatra as well. They need the toll roads also. They need the development. Other parts of the country need this rapid development as well. Because, as you know, Indonesia's story has always been one of trying to keep the archipelago together. It's not a nation that necessarily hangs together easily because of all of those different cultures. And I think they may have a problem on their hands if there is extraordinary growth and development just in Jakarta or just in Java, and if that's not spread elsewhere.
Well, that makes a perfect segue to, because these are the sorts of questions you put to any economist, and you're speaking to a pretty special one.
Yeah, Murray Pangestu is formerly with the World Bank. She was managing director. She was also the trade minister here in Indonesia. She's now on this advisory group working with President Prabowo. So she's very well connected. She was also involved with advising on the tariff negotiations with the Trump administration. She's a very respected figure here in Indonesia. This is Murray Pangestu. Murray Pangestu, welcome to Global Roaming. Selamat pagi.
Thank you, Hamish. Very happy to be on your program.
Indonesia is changing a lot. It's changed quite a lot in the decade or so since I've been here. For Australian listeners that think they know Indonesia, know its story, what's different?
Well, if you talk about 20 years ago, of course, we are now a full-blown democracy. We have had a good start and have been able to consolidate our democracy. So I think that's different. And we have gone through a process, as most new democracies have gone through, ups and downs, a lot of noise, but I think able to use the processes there if there are, you know, candidates being contested. There's a process now, and we actually have directly elected not just our president, but also governors and local leaders. And I think it's provided a lot of room for growth of local politician, local capability. As you know, our previous president was the mayor of Solo and then governor of Jakarta before he became president. Apart from that, obviously, we've grown, we've overcome the financial crisis and able to grow again and develop our economy. A lot of it's still natural resource-based, as Australia has the same issue, actually. Natural resources are both a curse and a blessing. But we have tried to continue to diversify our economy and also improved a lot on other fronts, such as poverty, human development, and so on.
The economic growth story is pretty impressive. The numbers are pretty impressive, and the forecasts are kind of mind-boggling. But I suppose the story of Indonesia has often been that it hasn't met its potential. Do you think anything is different now?
I think we still face the constraints that need to be overcome, including infrastructure, despite the progress made with infrastructure under the previous president. Obviously, there's still a lot of infrastructure bottlenecks. And, you know, we know this because if we look at kind of surveys on investment climate and cost of doing business, logistics and efficiency of flow of goods, not just internationally but nationally, is is an issue. So I think
what are we talking? Toll roads, wharves, train lines, airports? Is that the infrastructure?
Yeah, and connectivity. Don't forget, we're an archipelago, so it is quite challenging to have connectivity in a country that's so large geographically. So I think connectivity between the land and the sea and the air, both for economic transportation of goods as well as people. So because of tourism, right? Because apparently the cost of coming to Indonesia is still higher.
You mean for foreign businesses, for investors? Is that what you mean?
Yes, yes, yeah. And then we have, besides infrastructure, we do have to improve the climate for doing business, reduce the cost of doing business. It's related to the usual issues like bureaucracy, red tape, how to streamline, how to make more efficient.
Do you sense that other governments, other countries are still nervous about doing business here? You know, they're worried about corruption, or they're worried about getting tied up in sort of mind-boggling red tape.
I would say this is not just a concern of foreign investors, it's also the concern of domestic investors. So on any of these survey of doing business, that does come up. You know, the cost of doing business in terms of bureaucracy, inconsistencies in policies, implementation, ineffective implementation, they all come up, and lack of transparency. These all come up, and I think we have identified those issues. And the president last year did promise that he will do comprehensive deregulation. So I have heard that
yes, before from yes. Indonesian presidents.
Yeah. So this time round, we have seen some progress because I'm at the National Economic Council, and we've been helping the president on some of the recommendations. We've been able to improve the minimum wage setting process. We're now working on the investment licensing processes to make it a one-stop service, online and so on.
We're in Indonesia right now for Global Roaming's Indonesia series. And our guest today is Mari Pangestu. She's an Indonesian economist, ministerial advisor, and a former minister for trade, a very authoritative view of Indonesia.
You mentioned your role advising the current president, but also the need for more infrastructure. As I understand it, he's slightly veered away from the course that Jokowi had set, building all of these toll roads and large capital works projects. Do you think this whole idea of giving everyone free lunches comes at a cost of these other big projects?
Doesn't have to be.
but is it? Yes. Is that what's happening?
Well, let's put it this way. I think his view, which is different from President Jokowi, is that the infrastructure building doesn't have to be all from government. Yeah, actually, the problem under Jokowi, which was on the record from the private sector, was the private sector felt they were being crowded out by the government because all the infrastructure was being built by state-owned enterprises funded by budget. Right. So this president would like to see a different model where more public-private partnerships using our sovereign wealth fund, Danantara, to be part of it and wanting it to be more efficient. And at the same time, he believes in kind of having development address the issues from the bottom up. And that's the reason for the nutritious food program as well as the cooperatives, the red and white cooperatives.
Indonesia, as you've mentioned, is a huge place. So much of the population sits in Java, so much of the economic growth sits in Java. Do you have an emerging problem as Indonesia's economy grows that you're going to actually exacerbate those big disparities that people in the Maluku's or West Papua might not feel any sense of the growth, of the opportunity that comes with that?
That's the reason why we do need to focus on infrastructure. And I would say that, I guess, part of the legacy of President Jokowi was he did actually focus on building roads in Papua as well as in eastern Indonesia. But it's not enough to build roads. You have to have the connectivity. How do they connect to the market? And that is about the ports, the airports, and the transportation that needs to go with it. And I think a big challenge for Indonesia to have more inclusive growth is human resource development. So it is about education, and that's why, in a way, the nutritious meal program should really... a lot of the evaluation is showing that we are not able to address the remote areas as well as we do in Java, because in Java, a lot of the program acceleration is happening in Java just because the infrastructure and the accessibility is much easier. But the moment you talk about remote areas, then it's much, much more difficult. So maybe you need a different model to deliver the nutritious food program as well as education. And how do you develop the entrepreneurship, develop the capacity of the human resources in those regions?
Can you give Australians a sense of what Indonesia looks like by mid-century if it hits all of these growth targets? You know, we're talking about the world's fourth largest economy, potentially, if everything goes well. I mean, that's a very different power dynamic in the region. It's a very different bilateral relationship, presumably, but also it's a different experience for people that are Indonesian. Do you have a view of what this place will be?
We should be a developed country by then. That's the ambition and the vision. But I think whatever it is, we hopefully if we get some of the reforms right, we will be able to grow at a higher rate, because we do need to grow at a higher rate to be able to absorb the new entrance to the labor force.
Because you want 8% growth, right?
And this is what the 5%. President is aspiring to.
Yeah.
But he always says, okay, look, if I tell you I aspire to be 6%, you'll all work hard and maybe we get 5%. But if I say my aspiration is 8%, you'll all work hard and maybe we'll get 6-7%. So for him, it's...
Oh,
it's
come on. You've got an economics background.
I know. I'm just saying the way we try to look at it. I think if we can grow at 6-7%, that's already, in a way, good enough. We will reach a developed country status with 6-7% growth. So getting to 6-7% growth is challenging, especially given the external environment we're in and the challenges of human resources, infrastructure, connectivity, and so on. But I think if we can address those and also use... there are two emerging issues which Indonesia will have to grapple with, just as many other countries have to grapple with. One is obviously climate change. We have to have a green growth strategy, which gets us to higher growth, but in a sustainable manner, and digital. Everybody's facing the challenges of digitalization as well as AI. And we are going to have a big program on GovTech, which is about digitalization of government, and that hopefully that will reduce corruption and increase efficiency, right? So hopefully by mid-century, we will have, we'll continue to grow in terms of population. So that's probably something Australia and Australians need to be aware of. We are a large country, but we are not threatening. We want to be your good neighbor. You can't choose your neighbors, so let's be good neighbors. We have a lot of complementarity. A lot of I think more Indonesian students actually study in Australia than any other country. And so there's a lot of goodwill for, you know, me, like including me. I'm a Australian primary school, high school, university alumni. And
where did you go to primary school and high school?
Hughes Primary School.
Yeah, okay, where's that? In Canberra.
Canberra.
Yeah, okay.
And then Canberra High School.
Okay.
And then ANU. So, you know, people who like me, there are many people like me who have positive view about Australia and have connection and network with Australia. And I think that's a good basis for the Australia-Indonesia bilateral relations. I just came back from Canberra, by the way, where we had a very good meeting between Australians and Indonesians on economic security and how we can work together to face the uncertainties in the world, as well as in the regional platforms that we are part of.
You mentioned green energy, but I suppose there's an acute and immediate energy question for
the
region.
Yes, obviously. Yeah.
Are you talking to other countries in Southeast Asia or North Asia or Australia about whether this region, given that it does have a lot of these natural resources anyway, of the fossil fuel kind,
Is there some way of inoculating this region from the turmoil of the Middle East?
Yes, foreign ministers, ASEAN foreign ministers are meeting next week, I think. They already raised the issue. How do we cooperate on energy, right? There's already an ASEAN petroleum agreement that is being updated. And it is about, you know, joint development, sharing and diversification of sourcing, as well as the potential for cooperation of reserves sharing, because we have a similar program with rice. We have an ASEAN Rice Emergency Reserve Program, which then was expanded to ASEAN plus three, Japan, Korea, and China. So in other words, if there's an emergency or if you experience natural disaster, which happened in Myanmar maybe 10 years ago, cyclone, then they can draw on these reserves to get supplies. So the same thing can happen with energy. I think there have been discussions about how do we do this. So it's basically using the region, you know, you're better off facing such uncertainties, such shocks as a region, not country by country. That's kind of the rationale. And we discussed this in our bilateral between Australia and Indonesia, and then not just between Australia and Indonesia, but also how do we use the regional platforms.
But the way Indonesia approaches the world is quite different from Australia's. You know, you famously have this kind of friend to everyone approach. And I suppose in Australia, we're feeling a little stranded, maybe a little more isolated than we have in the past, because the great and powerful friend might not be there. They may not even be a friend. Who knows? Is it a better way of doing things, do you think, in this more transactional world, the Indonesian approach?
No, I don't think we are transactional. I think we need to navigate just now. You know, we talk a lot about how do we deal with the U.S. Actually, we also have to deal with China, right? But China is our ASEAN's largest trading partner, and ASEAN is China's largest trading partner. So we do have to navigate our relationships, but we don't do it in a way that, okay, I'm going to increase protection to protect myself. We have to do it in a way which is based on what we believe works, which is we still believe in openness. I think you can look at the president's speech in Davos at the World Economic Forum. He says, Indonesia is not afraid of economic integration. We believe that this is still going to lead us to prosperity, something like that, right? Because right now, economic integration, economic interdependence is seen as a vulnerability. No, it's not. It's actually a way, if we can do it based on common framework, common rules of openness, rules-based, and recognizing each other's different. Of course, Australia and Indonesia are different in many ways, but we can still agree on common principles.
Yeah. You mentioned navigating both America and China. Which one's more predictable?
At the moment, China. and you know, we have had a fairly good relationship with China, but of course we also have concerns, just as all countries have concerns.
Debt traps, with China. That kind of thing?
No, I don't think we have debt traps. We are more concerned about excess capacity issues.
Products flooding?
Yes, their products coming to our country and flooding our markets. It's not just our concern. I think most countries have similar concern. So you have so-called trade defense instruments like anti-dumping and countervailing duty to address import surges. But sometimes that's not enough. So I believe there needs to be a dialogue with China. So in other words, I think what we're trying to say is, look, there's also in all this uncertainty with what's happening with the U.S. and economic and geopolitical tensions, there's actually an opportunity to diversify the supply chain and deconcentrate and so on. And that requires Chinese investments of the nature that helps to build the supply chain in our part of the world, including Australia, right? You can take something like renewable energy, where China is clearly in the lead, but it does need our minerals at the same time. So the critical mineral supply chain linked to the semiconductors, linked to the electrification supply chains. There is a lot that this region can diversify and deepen in each country according to its comparative advantages.
Mari Pangestu, terima kasih.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I did enjoy hearing her, Hamish Mari Pangestu, the Indonesian economist. Now, I could feel her particularly, again, carefully digesting and sort of sorting what you were asking her. The distinction between Prabowo and Jokowi was very interesting. I think she probably preferred working with Jokowi.
Look, I think it is a question that's going to emerge as this mini-series unfolds, Geraldine, is the extent to which Prabowo is a break with the presidents of the past two sort of iterations. So SBY, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, then President Jokowi, these have been pretty predictable leaders for Australia to interact with. And Prabowo is an entirely different character, right? Like he, you know, he's very comfortable with signing up to Trump's Board of Peace. He's also signed up to the BRICS. He's quite digitally literate. He's a big reader. You know, he's always on the phone. He's doing his social media. He used TikTok a lot during the election campaign.
Yes, and look, I know that comparisons are awful things, but we have had some interesting feedback about ASEAN and about our relationship there from Adrian, for instance, who says, I think Singapore is a country we can learn a lot from in terms of managing relationships with China while running a highly effective globally integrated economy. We need to focus closely on how we work together. We can also learn from others in ASEAN, such as Thailand and Malaysia, who also maintain friendly relations with China while globally integrated. ASEAN, the organisation, generally looks like a loose amalgamation, so not sure about its value. But if they value us, they may also need to work on the relationship because this is a two-way street.
Another email from Andrew in Avalon. He wrote about our episode that I did with Kylie on education in Southeast Asia. On April 7, with Hamish in Jakarta, he raised the overt approach of forgiveness by Jeannine Gusmao to reconciliation with Indonesia. Gusmao had used that approach from the beginning of the Timor-Leste journey in 1999. He was following the lead of the master of reconciliation, Nelson Mandela, who also had forgiveness at the centre of his approach. With what has been happening in the Middle East, to ensure a lasting peace, reconciliation is going to take some momentous leadership. Yeah, it's a good point, Gerald, and I suppose you allude to that occasionally. Where are these leaders that are willing to stand up and make those sorts of noises? We're certainly not hearing it in other parts of the world at the moment.
Well, certainly not at the moment. We absolutely are not. That's the heart. At what point in nations' development are people sort of sufficiently comfortable, or I suppose confident is the word. See, this is what I think is so interesting about Indonesia, that their identity is settled, because that's, to me, the real story of the world at the moment. These identity dramas all around the world, possibly as a result of the amount of globalization. And so there's so much sense of instability. Now, from what you've been telling us and we've been hearing, Indonesia, despite its incredibly big archipelago, the people are observably Indonesian, are they? Would you say that? They know who they are?
Yeah, very much so. I think there's still very much strong local identity, because remember as well, it's not just about saying we're Indonesian. People will tell you about what it's like to be Javanese or Balinese or from Sumatra. Traveling to Sumatra during this trip, you go to these cities that maybe you've never heard of that have a very specific local cuisine, and literally everyone there, the first question they ask you is, have you tasted the pampa? What did you think? Do you know it's a fish cake? You know, so there is, I think, strong identity, but as always in Indonesia, difficult to define.
Yes, we'll have more compelling insights into Indonesia in our Global Roaming mini-series. So do write to us, won't you? Again, particularly about Indonesia or other things. Feedback is really vital to us. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. So we'll be back next week, Hamish. Keep enjoying yourself.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.